translated by their primitive mind, their impressions take the form of these fantastic demigods and spirits of 100 kinds with whom they have densely populated the solitudes of Tibet, and whose whimsical demeanor is the inexhaustible theme of a rich folklore. On the other hand, just as the Chaldean shepherds of yore observing the starry sky, on the shore of Euphrates laid the foundation of astronomy, so Tibetan anchorites and itinerant shamans have long pondered over the mysteries of their bewitching country and noted the phenomena which they found a favorable ground. A strange art had its origin in their contemplations and, many centuries ago, the magicians from the northern Transhimalayan land were already known and held in high repute in India. Now, in spite of its remoteness, Tibet is not altogether inaccessible. This, I can well testify. I have several times reached its southern tableland through different Himalayan passes, traveled for years in its eastern provinces and the northern Chinth, and during my last journey, I crossed the whole country from its southeastern border to Lhasa. Any robust man or woman who does not fear hardships might do the same but for the policy which closes Tibet. It is certain that, especially since the introduction of Buddhism, numbers of Indians, Nepalese, Chinese and other travelers have visited Tibet, seen its bewildering sights and heard about the supernormal powers with which its stutterbs are credited. Amongst them, a few have probably approached the lamas or bonpos magicians and listened to the mystic doctrines of contemplative hermits. Their travelers' tales, which inevitably grew and amplified as they were circulated, must have greatly contributed, together with the causes I have mentioned and other less apparent ones, to create around Tibet the glamorous atmosphere it now enjoys. Must we conclude that the renown of Tibet as the land in which prodigies flourish is entirely based on delusion? This would be as great an error as the uncritical acceptance of all the native tales, or of those lately conceived by the fertile brains of some facetious Westerners. The best way is to be guided by the rather surprising opinion of the Tibetans themselves regarding miraculous events. None in Tibet deny that such events may take place, but no one regards them as miracles, according to the meaning of that term in the West, that is to say as supernatural events. Indeed, Tibetans do not recognize any supernatural agent. The so-called wonders, they think, are as natural as common daily events and depend on the clever handling of little-known laws and forces. All facts which, in other countries, are considered miraculous or, in any other way, ascribed to the arbitrary interference of beings belonging to other worlds, are considered by Tibetan adepts of the secret law as psychic phenomena. In a general way, Tibetans distinguish two categories of psychic phenomena. 1. The phenomena which are unconsciously produced either by one or by several individuals. In that case, the author, or authors, of the phenomenon acting unconsciously, it is obvious that he does not aim at a fixed result. 2. The phenomena produced consciously, with a view of bringing about a prescribed result. These are generally, but not always, the work of a single person. That person may be a man or may belong to any one of the six classes of sentient beings which Lamaists acknowledge as existing in our world. Whosoever be its author, the phenomenon is produced by the same process. In accordance with some natural laws, there is no miracle. It may be of interest to remark here that Tibetans are staunch determinists. Each volition, they believe, is brought about by a number of causes, of which some are near and others extremely remote. I shall not lay stress on that point which is outside the present subject. However, the reader must bear in mind that, according to Tibetans, each phenomenon, consciously or unconsciously generated, as well as each of our bodily or mental actions, is the fruit of manifold combined causes. Amongst these causes, the first and more easily discernible ones are those which have arisen in the mind of the doer of the action, the conscious will of doing it. To these causes Tibetans assimilate those which, even unknown to the doer, have put into motion some forces which have led him to perform the action. Both kinds are styled jayu, immediate or principal cause. Then, come the outside causes, not originating with the doer, which may have helped the accomplishment of the action. These are called kine. The remote causes are often represented by their descendants. 234. In Tibetan rigs, as an instance, the milk is present in the butter or cheese, the seed is present in the tree born from it. Tibetans freely use these illustrations. These descendants are the present conditions which exist as the effects of bodily or mental actions which have been done in the past, but not, necessarily, done by the doer of the present act himself. So, when concentration of thoughts is mentioned here below as the direct cause of a phenomenon, one must remember, first that, according to Tibetan mystics, this concentration is not spontaneous, but determined, and secondly, that beside this direct apparent cause, there exist, in the background, a number of secondary causes which are equally necessary to bring about the phenomenon. The secret of the psychic training, as Tibetans conceive it, consists in developing a power of concentration of mind greatly surpassing even that of men who are, by nature, the most gifted in this respect. Mystic masters affirm that by the means of such concentration of mind, waves of energy are produced which can be used in different ways. The term wave is mine. I use it for clearness' sake and also because, as the reader will see, Tibetan mystics really mean some currents or waves of force. However, they merely say shugzortsal, that is to say, energy. That energy, they believe, is produced every time that a physical or mental action takes place. Action of the mind, of the speech and of the body. According to the Buddhist classification, the production of psychic phenomena depends upon the strength of that energy and the direction in which it is pointed. An object can be charged by these waves. It then becomes something resembling our electric accumulators and may give back, in one way or another, the energy stored in it. For instance, it will increase the vitality of one who touches it, infuse him with courage, etc. Practices grounded on this theory and aiming at beneficial results are current in Tibet. Numbers of lamas prepare pills, holy water, knotted scarves, charms printed on paper or cloth, which are supposed to impart strength and health, or to keep away accidents, evil spirits, robbers, bullets and so on. The lama must first purify himself by a proper diet and then concentrate his thoughts on the object which he means to empower, in order to load it with wholesome influences. Several weeks or months are sometimes deemed necessary for that preparation. However, when it is only a question of charmed scarves, these are often knotted and consecrated in a few minutes. 3. The energy which is communicated to an object pours into it a kind of life. That inanimate object becomes able to move and can perform certain actions at the command of its maker. The Ngagspas are said to resort to these practices, to hurt or kill without arousing any suspicion that they are responsible for the casualty. Here is an instance of the way in which the sorcerer proceeds. Taking with him the object which is to be animated, let us say a knife destined to kill someone, the Ngagspa shuts himself in seclusion for a period that may last over several months. During that time he sits, concentrating his thoughts on the knife in front of him and endeavoring to transfer to the inanimated object his will to kill the particular individual whose death has been planned. Various rites are often performed in connection with the Ngagspa's concentration of mind. These aim at adding to the energy which the latter is capable of generating and transfusing into the knife. Beings deemed more powerful than the sorcerer are either besought to cooperate willingly with him or coerced and compelled to let their energy flow into the weapon. These beings are often of a demoniacal kind, but in the case when the murder is deemed righteous action useful to the welfare of many, lofty benevolent entities may be called in as helpers. These are always respectfully implored and no one attempts to coerce them. Some Ngagspas think it useful to bring the weapon into touch with the man whom it is meant to kill or with objects habitually used by him. Other adepts of the black art scoff at such a childish practice and declare that it discloses utter ignorance regarding the causes which may bring about the killing or hurting that is to appear accidental. When the sorcerer supposes that the knife is ready to perform its work, it is placed near the man who is to become its victim so that, almost always, he may be led to use it. Then, as soon as he seizes it, the knife moves, gives a sudden impulse to the hand which holds it, and the man against whom it has been prepared stabs himself. It is said that when once the weapon has been animated in that way, it becomes dangerous for the Ngagspa who, if he lacks the knowledge and cleverness required to guard himself, may fall its victim. Autosuggestion is likely to result from the protracted meditation and the elaborate rites performed by the sorcerer while dwelling in seclusion, and it would not be surprising if some accident occurred to him. Nevertheless, apart from the stories of demons and spirits, there may be a phenomenon similar to that which is said to occur when the phantom created by a magician breaks away from its maker's control. Certain lamas and a few bonpos have told me that it is a mistake to believe, in such cases as I have just mentioned, that the knife becomes animated and kills the man. It is the man, they said, who acts on autosuggestion as a result of the sorcerer's concentration of thought. Though the Ngagspa only aims at animating the knife, the man against whom the rites are performed is closely associated in his mind with the idea of the weapon. And so, as that man may be a fit receiver of the occult waves generated by the sorcerer, while the knife is not, he falls unconsciously under their influence. Then, when touching the prepared knife, the view and touch of the latter put into motion the suggestion existing, unknown to him, in the man's mind, and he stabs himself. Moreover, it is strongly believed that without any material object for transmission, proficient adepts of the secret law can suggest, even from afar, to men or other beings, the idea of killing themselves in one way or another. All agree in saying that any such attempt cannot be successful against an adept in psychic training because such a one detects the waves of forces pointed at him and is able to discriminate their nature and thrust back those which he deems harmful. For, without the help of any material object, the energy generated by the concentration of thoughts can be carried to more or less distant points. There this energy may manifest itself in various manners. For instance, it can bring about psychic phenomena. It can penetrate the goal ascribed to it and thus transfer the power generated elsewhere. Mystic masters are said to use this process during the Angkor rites. Much could be said about these rites and the spirit which pervades them. The limited space allowed in an average size volume forbids an exhaustive account of all theories and practices of mystic lamaism, and I have reluctantly had to omit for the present a number of interesting subjects. I shall confine myself to a few words. Lamaist Angkor, literally empowerment, is not an initiation, though, for lack of other words, I have sometimes used that term in the course of the present book. The various Angkors are not meant to reveal esoteric doctrines, as initiations were, among the Greeks and other peoples. They have a decidedly psychic character. The theory about them is that energy may be transmitted from the master, or from some more occult store of forces, to the disciple who is able to tap the psychic waves in transmission. According to Lamaist mystics, during the performance of the Angkor rite, a force is placed within the disciple's reach. The seizing and assimilating of that force is left to his ability. In the course of talks I had on this subject with mystic initiates, they have defined Angkor as a special opportunity offered to a disciple of empowering himself. By the same method, mystic masters are said to be able to dispatch waves of energy which, in case of need, cheer, refresh and invigorate, physically and mentally, their distant disciples. The process is not always meant to enrich the goal to which the waves are directed. On the contrary, sometimes when reaching that goal, these waves absorb a portion of its energy. Then, returning with this subtly stolen spoil, they pour it into the post from which they have been sent forth, and in which they are reabsorbed. Some magicians, it is said, gain great strength or prolong their lives by incorporating this stolen energy. 5. Tibetan mystics also affirm that adepts well trained in concentration are capable of visualizing the forms imagined by them and can thus create any kind of phantom, men, deities, animals, inanimate objects, landscapes, and so forth. The reader must recall what has been said on this subject in reference to the Tulkas Sea, a famous Tibetan monastery, on page 58, and the innumerable phantoms which, according to the Dalai Lama, A Chenchup Sempa has the power to generate. These phantoms do not always appear as impalpable mirages. They are tangible and endowed with all the faculties and qualities naturally pertaining to the beings or things of which they have the appearance. For instance, a phantom horse trots and neighs. The phantom rider who rides it can get off his beast, speak with the traveler on the road and behave in every way like a real person. A phantom house will shelter real travelers, and so on. Such happenings abound in Tibetan stories and especially in the famous epic of King Jizer of Ling. The great hero multiplies himself. He produces phantom caravans with tent, hundreds of horses, lamas, merchants, servants, and each of them plays his part. In battles he creates phantom armies which kill their enemies just as well as if they were authentic warriors. All this appears to belong to the realm of fairy tales, and one may wisely assume that 99 out of 100 of these stories are purely mythical. Yet disconcerting incidents occur, phenomena are witnessed which it is impossible to deny. Explanations of them are to be found by the observer himself, if he refuses to accept those offered by Tibetans. But often these Tibetan explanations, on account of their vaguely scientific form, attract the inquirer and become themselves a field of investigation. Western travelers who have approached the Tibetan border and formed a superficial idea of the common folk's superstitions will be most surprised to hear of the strangely rationalistic and skeptical opinion of prodigies which these apparently credulous simpletons harbor in the depth of their minds. Two stories, which are known and famous all over Tibet, will serve to illustrate the matter. Whether the facts related be authentic or not is of no importance to us. Our interest hangs on the explanation given of the cause of the miracle and the spirit which pervades the whole story. Once upon a time, a trader was travailing with his caravan on a stormy day, and his hat was carried away by the wind. Tibetans believe that to pick up a hat which has fallen down in such circumstances in the course of a journey will bring bad luck. So yielding to that superstition, the merchant abandoned his hat. It was a soft felt hat, with fur laps that can be worn turned up or covering the ears, as the weather requires. Buried between the thorny shrubs where it had been violently tossed by the wind, its shape was hardly recognizable. A few weeks later, a man passing by that place at dusk noticed an undistinguishable form which seemed to be crouched among the thickets. He was not too brave and hurriedly passed his way. On the morrow he told some villagers that he had seen something strange at a short distance from the path. Other travelers also remarked at that very spot a peculiar object whose nature they could not ascertain, and spoke of it to the villagers. Then, others again and again had a look at the innocent hat and called the attention of the country people to it. Now, sun, rain and dust helped to make the hat a stiff, more mysterious-looking object. The felt had taken on a dirty yellowish-brown color and the fur laps looked vaguely like an animal's ears. Traders and pilgrims stopping in the village were warned that, at the skirt of the forest, a thing, neither man nor beast, remained in ambush and it was necessary to be on the watch. Someone suggested that the thing must be a demon and soon the object, anonymous till then, was promoted to the rank of a devil. As months went by, more people cast a fearful glance at the old hat, more people spoke about it and the whole country came to talk of the demon hidden at the border of the wood. Then one day it happened that some passers-by saw the rag moving. Another day it tried to extricate itself from the thorns that had grown around it, and finally it followed a party of wayfarers who ran, panic-stricken, for their lives. The hat had been animated by the many thoughts concentrated on it. That story, which Tibetans affirm to be authentic, is given as an instance of the power of concentration of mind, even when unconsciously affected, and not aiming at a prescribed result. The second story has on the appearances of having been invented by a miscreant joker to ridicule the devotees, but it is not so. No one in Tibet finds it laughable or irreverent. The fact related is accepted as revealing a strict truth about all cults. Whatever it may be, the worshipped object is only possessed with the power, which is supplied to it by the collective concentration of thoughts and the faith of its worshippers. The aged mother of a trader who went each year to India, asked her son to bring her a relic from the Holy Land. The trader promised to do so, but his mind being much occupied with the cares of his business, he forgot his promise. The old woman felt very sad, and the next year, when her son's caravan started again, she renewed her request for the holy relic. Again the trader promised to bring one, and again he forgot it. The same thing happened for the third time the following year. However, this time the merchant remembered his promise before reaching his home and was much troubled at the idea of once more disappointing his aged mother's eager expectation. As he pondered over the matter, seeking a way to mend his neglect, he caught sight of a piece of a dog's jaw lying near the road. A sudden inspiration came to him. He broke off a tooth of the bleached jawbone, wiped away the earth which covered it and wrapped it in a piece of silk. Then, having reached his house, he offered the old bone to his mother, declaring that it was a most precious relic, a tooth of the great Sariputra. 238. A prominent personal disciple of the Buddha. Overjoyed, her heart filled with veneration, the good woman placed the tooth in a casket on the altar of the family shrine. Each day she worshipped before it, lighting lamps and burning incense. Other devotees joined in the worship and after a time rays of light shone from the dog's tooth, promoted holy relic. A popular Tibetan saying is born from that story, Mosgasyotna, Kai Soa Tung, which means if there is veneration even a dog's tooth emits light. Once more we see that Tibetan theories about all phenomena are always the same at heart. All are grounded on the power of the mind and this is only logical for people who consider the world, as we see it, to be but a subjective vision. The power of becoming invisible at will, exhibited by numbers of magicians in the tales of all nations, is finally ascribed, by Tibetan occultists, to the cessation of mental activity. Truly, Tibetan legends tell us about material contrivances for causing invisibility. Among them is the Dipshing which appears in so many stories. It is the fabulous wood which a strange crow hides in its nest. The smallest fragment of it ensures complete invisibility to the man, beast or object which holds it or near which it is placed. But great Naljorpas and Dubjins need not possess any magic material implement to make themselves invisible. From what I have been able to understand, adepts in psychic training do not see this prodigy in the same way as the profane. According to them, it is not a question of juggling oneself away, but of taking care not to arouse any feeling in the sentient beings by whom one is surrounded. By that means one's presence is not detected or, at a lesser degree, one is scarcely noticed by those before whose eyes one passes, one does not excite any reflection in their mind and does not leave any impression in their memory. The explanations which have been given to me of this matter may be roughly summarized as follows. When one walks, making a loud noise and many gestures, jostling against men and things, one arouses many sensations in many people. Attention is roused in those who feel these sensations and that attention is directed to the one who causes them. If, on the contrary, one steals along noiselessly without touching anybody, one arouses few sensations, these are not vivid, they awaken only slight attention in those who experience them and, consequently, one is but little noticed. Yet, however motionless and silent one may be, the work of the mind generates an energy which spreads all around the one who produces it, and this energy is felt in various ways by those who come into touch with it. But if one succeeds in stopping all activity of the mind, one arouses no sensations in others and so one is not seen. As I thought this theory too fantastic, I objected that in any case, the material body must remain visible. The reply was as follows, at each moment, a large number of objects are within our view, yet we only notice a few of them. The others do not make any impression on us. No knowledge-consciousness follows the visual contact. If Mandana's arguments triumphed, Sankara would have to give up his religious garb and marry, while in the event Mandana would be compelled to renounce his wife and home and to don the orange robe, the badge of ultimate renunciation. We do not remember that this contact has taken place. Practically, these objects have remained invisible to us. However interested we may feel in the other strange accomplishments with which Tibetan adepts of the secret lore are credited, The creation of thought forms seems by far the most puzzling. We have already seen in the preceding chapter how the novice is trained to build up the form of his tutelary deity, but in that case the aim is a kind of philosophical enlightenment. The goal is different in other cases. In order to avoid confusion, we will first consider another kind of phenomena which is often discussed, not only in Tibet, but in various other Eastern countries and even in the West. Some profess to see a certain analogy between these and the creation of thought forms, but, in fact, the process is not at all the same. In nearly all countries there are people who believe in a subtle soul or spirit which, while the body lies asleep or in a cataleptic trance, can roam about in various places. They perform different deeds, sometimes associating for that purpose with a material body other than that with which it is habitually united. Tales of witches going to the Sabbat were common during the Dark Ages, and investigations proved that, generally, the witch was lying unconscious in a trance all the time. Nevertheless, when coming to her senses again, she described at length the wonders of the infernal orgy at which she believed she had been a guest. Numbers of hysterical women have been burnt at the stake for having such delusions. In India, countless legends relate the strange adventures of men, demigods, or demons who enter dead bodies, act in guise of the dead man and then revert to their own frame which had meanwhile remained unconscious. The most famous of these stories is that of Sri Sankaracharya, the celebrated Vedantin philosopher to whom Indian Brahmins are indebted for having re-established them in the privileged position that had been severely shaken by the rationalist Buddhist doctrine. His personality as it appears to us through half-legendary biographies must have been most remarkable. Unfortunately, a sort of political caste interest seems to have dimmed his otherwise bright intelligence. It made him a champion of baneful social theories which were in complete contradiction to the lofty pantheism which he preached. Sankaracharya, so runs the story, had challenged a rival philosopher named Mandana, who was a supporter of the ritualistic creed of Karma Mimamsa, 243. The doctrine that salvation can only be attained through sacrifices to the deities, worship, sacraments and ritualistic performances. Sankara held the opposite view, that is to say, salvation is the fruit of knowledge. 243. And it had been settled that whoever was defeated in the discussion should become his opponent's disciple and embrace the same condition of life as his master. The holy scriptures, she said, declare that wife and husband are one. So, having defeated my husband, you have only defeated one half of our being. Your victory cannot be admitted until you defeat me also. Sankara had no reply. The objection was grounded on orthodox beliefs. He began another philosophic tournament. The lady, understanding that her knowledge and controversial ability could not vie with those of her opponent, saved herself by a clever stratagem. Indian sacred scriptures classify among the orthodox sciences the art of sensual love. Bharati put certain questions on that peculiar subject to Sankara which confounded the ascetic. He excused himself for his ignorance by saying that he had been absorbed since his youth in philosophic meditations, and, as Sannyasin, being a strict celibate, women and all things connected with them were utterly unknown to him. However, he deemed himself quite capable of acquiring the knowledge which he lacked. Would not his charming adversary grant him about a month's leave to seek enlightenment? He was willing to resume the controversy at the end of the fixed time. Here Bharati must have imprudently undervalued the capacity of her opponent, or thought that such a short time would not be enough for him to master the required science. She acquiesced and Sankara started in quest of teachers. Now it happened that, at about that time, a Raja named Amaruka died. Sankara, who could not have undertaken his study in the person of an already famous ascetic, here saw a convenient opportunity. He ordered his disciples to guard his body in a remote spot while he transmitted his subtle self into the body of the prince which was being carried to the funeral pyre. The resuscitated Amaruka was taken back to his palace to the great joy of his several Rainis, legitimate wives and a good number of pretty concubines. Sankara showed himself a zealous scholar, pleasantly astonishing his spouses who had been somewhat neglected by the late elderly Raja. The ministers and counselors noticed, also, that since his resurrection their lord's intelligence had astonishingly increased. This clever ruler appeared altogether most unlike the dull Raja whom they had known for years.